It's one of those perks of Tesla's cutting-edge driverless technology, using your phone to summon your car from a parking spot. But who's on the hook if there's a crash if no one is behind the wheel? Your car, your crash, you're liable. At least that's what lawyers are saying after a number of videos have popped up showing cars running Smart Summon, Tesla's new software, and a number of near misses. But if the accidents pile up, insurance industry experts expect Tesla to be dragged into legal fights.
Brexit talks with the European Union to strike a last-minute deal are getting serious, the British government said on Sunday. But opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn says it's unlikely he'll back an agreement. Intense negotiations were taking place at the weekend after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson backed down in key areas, including dropping a demand for customs checks on the island of Ireland.
Kenyan runner Bridget Koskay crossed the finish line of the Chicago Marathon Sunday and stepped into sports history by becoming the fastest woman to ever run a marathon. And she not only broke the prior record, she smashed it. Her time, 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 4 seconds, was more than a minute faster than the record set by British runner Paula Radcliffe back in 2003. 25-year-old Koskay, who also won the Chicago Marathon in 2018, said this year's cheering crowd gave her the energy to run even faster.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. It is The Opening Bell on 720 WGN. I am not Steve Grzanich. He is out fighting illness like most of the people around Chicago at this time of the year, unfortunately, wishing him the best. But we're all in the capable hands of producer Bennett Wakenight this morning, so thank you very much. We're going to talk to Marissa Fernandez. She's a reporter at Axios in just a few minutes. We're going to talk about how universities and other educational organizations are buying high schoolers' personal data from SAT administrator, College Board, and others, how that can affect people looking to get into colleges and what the risks for students are. Also, later on, we're going to talk to WGN-TV reporter Megan Dwyer about various topics as well. She's got a story that we're looking forward to getting into. But first, we're going to check the Associated Bank market desk right now. Over the weekend activities, as you just heard Vic Vaughn mentioned at the top of the hour there, U.S. markets trending towards opening not too low at the moment. Things just about 0.5% is looking down from where it closed last week. However, Asian markets, the Nikkei, the Shanghai and Hang Seng all looking to open down from the weekend. Things not looking great. And European markets are also trending towards a negative open this morning. Also, we're looking at a few stories that might affect your money coming up this week. One of those is it's a bit of a complicated story, but basically this video game company, Blizzard Entertainment. It's a massive company that releases many AAA video game titles throughout the course of the year. $60-$65 a copy games, and they sponsor many e-sport tournaments. One of those recently was a tournament known as Hearthstone, and one of the most popular streamers for e-sports supported protesters in Hong Kong last week. He expressed during a tournament support for the protesters, pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, as opposed to the government in Beijing. And for that declaration of support, Blizzard has shut down the streamer known as Blitzchung. And because of that, it has spurred this boycott of Blizzard games. They own many other companies that also release games, independent projects. And it's something that soon we're looking to affect the overall sales of video games overall. And being such a massive industry, you know, over $60 billion last year, $100 billion projected for the next couple, Blizzard is a major player in that world, and it's definitely something that we're going to be keeping an eye on this morning and going forward. But right now, we'd like to get to our first guest. She is a reporter at Axios. Welcome to The Opening Bell, Marissa Fernandez. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks so much for getting up early and hopping on The Opening Bell with us. So this story about College Board buying the data for high school students and those who are applying for universities. How did this sort of come about? How did this get started, that this was a problem.
Absolutely, yeah. So Axios has been doing a series like this for a while now where we take a deep dive into companies' privacy practices. And College Board, which administers the SAT, one of the more popular standardized testing tests that help kids and high schoolers establish where they're going to go to college. The SAT makes, you know, it's a nonprofit, but it makes millions of dollars off of different ways that they can help students. And they emphasize that very deeply, that it's a service for students. But what is interesting is that they actually take the data that they acquire from students and they sell it to vetted institutions for educational purposes. And why this matters is usually, you know, students aren't worrying about how their data is being acquired when they're taking a test. It's a very high stress, high stakes Saturday morning. They just want to make sure they're trying to get into the college that they want. And sometimes we have found that the practices that the company is transparent about, it's not necessarily as clear to students and to parents and to teachers that the data is being sold off to students, or excuse me, to educational institutions.
Right. So this is something that I noticed in here, as you mentioned, it's not clear in those, you know, those that we all sign, those agreements, you know, when you're signing up for a service or something, the fine print or whatever, in terms of where this data is going to go. It seems like the fine print or what the students and parents and teachers are reading from these College Board websites and whatnot before they take the test, it seems like they're not aware that this data is being sold to third parties or where it's going to end up, similar to other situations that we're all facing, I think, in today's digital world.
Absolutely, yes, you're correct. So what's interesting about this is that this is not a part of the SAT test at all. It's a pre-survey that is passed out to students in various ways by the proctor, which essentially asks students, hey, would you like to opt into something called our student search service program, which essentially means that they're just going to take data from the students on, you know, what their interests are and what, you know, what they really want to do in college, what kind of college they're looking for. Is it a big school? Is it a small school? What are they looking to study? What are they interested in? What are their extracurricular activities? Do they play any sports? And they essentially put them into an online database that they consent to, and it essentially just tries to match them as best as they can with the college that they would like. Now, I want to stress really that this is a really great tool for students. Students, you know, especially if students come from small towns or, you know, they might not be interested in certain things or they don't know, they can definitely find a college that they would want to find through this system and that they never would have, you know, thought of before besides, you know, maybe a nearby state school. But essentially what happens is it's not really what we found is, and the experts that we've spoken to, it's not really clear that students know that their data is being used in this way.
Marissa, one of the things I noticed here is that it seems qualified parties can purchase each student's data for 47 cents. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. That's one thing that College Board makes known. And 47 cents for, you know, one institution to purchase students' data doesn't seem, you know, it's only two quarters, really. But we found that more than 3 million students in 2018 gave up their personal information in the process of taking a college entry exam. And so that can add up, especially if multiple institutions are paying for the same person's data. So, yeah, it can add up pretty quickly.
Right, it is. That's true. It's just, it is interesting, though. I mean, if it's one per, I mean, I can't even buy something from the vending machine for 47 cents anymore. And this is personal data. It's just, that was an interesting thing. The other thing that I thought, a specific example given as to how advantage is taken of these students is that one of the things that was sold to them, I guess, was like this prep party or a sort of prep event for SATs or for getting into colleges. And the students went there. It cost them $1,000. Them and their families to be at this event, and ultimately it gave them no benefits or advantages to applying to their colleges, right?
Absolutely. So, yes, the New York Times did an investigation last year where, so College Board stresses, of course, that third-party institutions are well-vetted in the benefit of students. But this organization slipped through the cracks, and essentially what happened was a third-party company used data to target lower-income students that were taking the SAT, and they essentially preyed on these students to pay for and have their parents save up and pay for this event that was sponsored as, you know, we're going to help you get into college. We're going to help you essentially, you know, start a future. We're going to have you talk to one of the premier experts that they advertise, you know, is like a college, you know, laureate, like all these things, right? And essentially what happened is that there was nothing this event, and pretty much everything that these students could learn on how to apply to college was very easily could have been researched online
for free,
or probably done from for free. And that was something that was pretty murky and essentially opened up some investigations into College Board's privacy practices, because this is something where lower-income students especially were preyed upon.
Right. Marissa, we're just up against the clock, but this has been very interesting, and thank you so much for joining the opening bell. That's Marissa Fernandez. You can see her reporting on this and many other things at Axios.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the opening bell on 720 WGN. I am Don Kleppen in for Steve Grzanich. And right now, the issue of bail reform has been a struggle in the Illinois area for the last few years. And that's what Megan Dwyer, who's an investigative reporter at WGN-TV, well, that's what she focused on in her conversation with Steve Grzanich.
Megan, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The issue of bail reform is one that has been front and center here in Cook County in the Chicago area, and in Illinois, really, because of some laws that have been passed. There, I know initially it was an economic thing where they didn't want people sitting in jail because they couldn't come up with the money, but there have been all kinds of issues surrounding that, non-economic, right?
Right. So I think that you're correct that the initial sort of push for bail reform, the stakeholders thought, listen, we've got too many low-level offenders, petty thieves, et cetera, who are poor, who can't afford to post, languishing in jail. It's clogging up the system. Taxpayers are fronting that bill. But also, I think there was some pull from leadership. Bail is a constitutional right. Everybody should be able to afford to post bail. And I think that's a really nuanced piece, I guess, of this issue that doesn't get discussed that much. You're not supposed to have to stay in jail before your trial unless you're really dangerous and it's clear that you're dangerous, or there's something in your past or present that suggests you might not come back to court for future hearings. And so I think they were trying to figure out a way to make sure that people who shouldn't be in jail were in jail. And unfortunately, there seems to be this unintended consequence where, arguably, some higher-level offenders who are caught with guns also end up getting out, you know?
Yeah, so as part of the investigation that you did, you looked over some gun cases from two of Chicago's historically most violent weekends, Memorial Day and Labor Day. What did you find?
Yeah, so I got the idea for the piece because I was sitting in a press conference, you know, the Monday morning violence press conference, and Superintendent Johnson said the media should really do their job. And I didn't really take offense at that, but I didn't know whether to believe him because he kept saying ad nauseum every single Monday, oh, we arrest the same people over and over again, and then my officers find them back out on the streets the next day. It's super frustrating. And I didn't want to take him at face value. I'm a reformed attorney, so I think I better understand the court system than most. And if I had the time and the resources, I wanted to look up every single gun case from the summer. But we chose those two weekends because that was, you know, a chunk that we could bite off, and I thought that it would give us an adequate sample set for the reality of what was happening. So I believe, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I looked up about 120 cases. About 8 of them, I think, ended up not being relevant, or the charges were not what we were looking at. But just so, I think 112 cases total for those two weekends, and these are gun weapons offense charges. So it includes everything from a baseline of just possessing a weapon, a UUW, to an aggravated UUW, to armed habitual criminal, to even murder. And of those, I believe 112 cases where somebody was caught with an illegal gun, whether they committed other crimes allegedly in the process of getting picked up on that specific charge, only, I believe, 8 people had to stay in jail because they did not get bail. And that to me is interesting because when bail reform was put into place, the idea was that, listen, we'd get the petty thieves out of the jail, but the really dangerous guys, they need to get no bail. And that was part of Chief Judge Tim Evans' order. And so I thought that the number of no bail cases would actually be much higher than that, but they weren't. And we also found that Johnson was right. In a vast majority of these cases, the offenders are getting out within 48 hours after either posting nothing because they got an I bond, or they, you know, had a low-level D bond up to $50,000, so $50,000 D bond, and these guys only have to post 10% of it. So the most anybody had to pay to leave jail, now this is all pre-trial, was $5,000. And 65% of the people who were out within 48 hours had previous criminal backgrounds. Yeah. And that, to me, was the statistic that kind of took my breath away.
Right, and you drill down even further into the numbers. By the way, if people are wondering, UUW means unlawful use of a weapon. But you drill down.
Ironically, yes.
Yeah, but you drill down. 72% of those folks were released on the very same day or the next day.
Yeah, or the next day, yeah, within 48 hours. Because here's the thing. Either they get I bonds. I think 30% of my data set got an I bond, which means they just are released on their own recognizance. The people who got out the very next day or within 48 hours, I mean, and Johnson has said this before, and I did see this in the data, a lot of these guys are gang members or they have access to resources. So paying $1,000 or $5,000 to get out isn't a big deal. And a chunk of these guys, and this is the problem for Sheriff Dart, because a chunk of these guys who are so dangerous, they need electronic monitoring, are also getting a cash bail. So it's kind of like, well, you can't have it both ways. Either they're dangerous or they're not. And if they're so dangerous, we should be keeping them in jail, not putting them on electronic monitoring, which, as we've seen, isn't really a place for violent offenders.
The sheriff, Tom Dart, has said just pretty matter-of-factly, this is not what anybody wants. This is probably not what this law was designed to do. The idea that you have potentially violent and violent offenders being released suggests that there's some changes need to be made in this law.
Yeah, and so I wish I could have gone more specifically into that. Joe Donlan did ask me on set after the second piece aired, hey, how do we fix this? And I think Micah Mater also raised that after the first piece aired. And it's really complicated, but there's a lot of different things that could happen. So I don't know if you're familiar, and this gets into the weeds, but it's really important. When somebody goes before a judge for a bail hearing, they are now, there's an analytics piece of this, so that there's a sliding scale between 1 and 6. Between 1 and 6, how dangerous are you? How likely are you to reoffend? And then between 1 and 6, how likely is it that you will not come back to court? And that is called the PSA, and it's, they take the data from the defendant's history, what the current charge is, yada, yada, socioeconomic status, and then they blurt out a number. And that number then is supposed to guide what the judges do. In places like New Jersey, you get like an extra demerit if your charge involves an illegal gun or you had an illegal gun or if you're a felon in possession, for example, so that you're more likely to get a 6 on that sliding scale. And then, as a result, the judge would be less likely to let you out of jail. Our system, how that 1 to 6 works, doesn't take into account guns. We have not sort of curated it for Chicago's violence, but we could, because the vendor that they use to come up with that number allows different jurisdictions around the country to kind of play with it. So that's one option. The other option is just less, I guess, specific, but the chief judge could issue another order. He could tell his judges, hey, I want you to really look at the juvenile record here in these cases. Sometimes they do that, sometimes they don't. But some of these guys, like one of the guys that I profiled, had a loaded AK-47 in the middle of the afternoon with an extended magazine pacing back and forth in front of an apartment building. He's only 19 years old. This was his first adult charge. And so I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing that part of the judge's decision-making, you know, was, hey, this is this kid's first offense, we're going to give him another shot. But it's a loaded AK-47, and I wonder what his juvenile record would show. So Judge Evans could say to the judges, please, really look into these juvenile records if they have guns, you know, or were found to have guns in the past. I mean, it's really, you've got to look at the whole picture. He could also instruct the judges sort of to do things a little bit differently when it comes to gun offenders. Or at the very least say, hey, if you're going to put somebody on electronic monitoring, maybe they shouldn't also get an I bond.
Right.
Because what message is that sending?
Well, and is it also...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Steve. The other alternative was the Bail Reform Act went into effect 2 years ago. Statutorily, there could be some changes here.
Yeah,
those could run the gamut.
That's what I was going to ask is, you know, whether any of that's already being discussed by lawmakers.
You know, I think so. It's all happening sort of behind cage doors, or closed doors, sorry. And I don't know why nobody wants to tell me specifically what's being discussed, but it does seem like there's some rumblings. I mean, in the very last page of the bail reform data that came out in May from the chief judge's office, on the very last page, almost a footnote, but on the very last page, they say, we are considering taking a second look at weapons offenses, and something like, quote, in the interest of public safety. So this has been on the court's radar since May. This has been Sheriff Dart, you know, saying, hey, guys, this is crazy. Something bad's going to happen for 2 years now. So I really don't understand, since there are so many different avenues to fix this, why it hasn't been fixed. The other issue here is that within the bail reform statute, there is a provision about domestic violence offenders. So if you have committed a crime of domestic violence, judges are encouraged to look at that differently and to maybe give you a different bail or no bail at all. I don't know why, when the legislature considered that they didn't carve out. And I realize that Chicago's not downstate. We've got different problems. But arguably gun crimes are an issue throughout our country. And so I think there could be some language statutorily added to that that could make it easier for judges to feel comfortable to keep some of these individuals in jail pretrial.
After hearing all of this and seeing your reporting, I have to ask the question, and you know, it goes back to Superintendent Eddie Johnson, what the crime numbers might look like in Chicago if some of these safeguards were put into place.
I don't know, and they don't know either. And the reason is we don't arrest people for shooting offenses. We very rarely catch people in the act. Sometimes these pod cameras will catch things, but by the time officers then arrive on scene, you know, they just have a gun. And I will say that within this data set, there are a lot of stop and frisk cases. There are a lot of, we're pulling over this person for a traffic offense and they have a gun in their car. And there's 4 other people in that car. So whose gun is it? You know, were they going to use it? Johnson would say, absolutely, yes. You don't walk around outside with a loaded AK-47 if you're not up to no good. But there's a contingent here of stakeholders who feel very strongly about the Constitution, and like Kim Fox, and she says, hey, you catch a guy with a gun in his back seat, and there's 4 guys in the car, and all they did was, like, run a stop sign. I don't know if I want a bright line rule that says that individual or all four of them have to be held before their trial and they can't be back out on the streets, you know, providing for their families, or do they have full-time jobs? And I will tell you, there was some people in the data who were arguably likely carrying a handgun for protection in certain neighborhoods. There was at least one individual in my data set who works for the post office, didn't have a FOID card. You know, I'm not saying, and that's exactly what Kim Fox said to me. She said, Megan, I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying that that's okay, but that's a different person than someone with a loaded assault rifle. And at the very least, we could just address the assault rifle issue, because I think everybody's on board there. But I obviously, nothing's been done yet.
Well, Megan, we appreciate you being on with us and sharing your reporting. It sounds like there's more developments coming in this story, and we look forward to hearing from you.
I hope so. Thanks so much for taking an interest. I think it's a really important discussion that we have as we all sort of try to, you know, understand the violence that's sort of so apparent in the city that we all love.
That was WGN-TV investigative reporter Megan Dwyer talking with Steve Grzanich on the Illinois issue of bail reform.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN. Checking the Associated Bank market desk this morning, U.S. market futures all trending upward for the most part this morning. Gold futures as well looking up, trending towards about 0.75% rising. And oil is down, futures anyway, down just about 2.5%. European markets all looking in the red this morning. The CAC and the DAX both about 0.75% downward, those futures anyway, and the Asian markets currently futures trending upwards. The Nikkei, the Hang Seng, and Shanghai all around 1% or higher, those futures looking this morning. Checking the latest agriculture and commodities right now, here's Orion Samuelson.
Well, the big question starting off this trading week is, will the China-U.S. trade talks continue to bring strength to the market? It certainly did on Friday. The December lean hog contract ended up $1.37 a hundredweight. The December wheat contract up 16.5 cents. December corn up 18, and November soybeans up 10.75 cents to end the trading day on Friday. Meanwhile, while we're getting ready to harvest and are harvesting here in the Northern Hemisphere, in South America, they're planting the next crop. And so far, Brazilian farmers have planted 9.5% of the expected area of soybeans for this year's crop. That's down considerably from the 21% planted at this time last year. Field work on the main producing states in Brazil, the world's largest producer of soybeans, has been delayed due to lack of rain. Meanwhile, another international note, China reporting a new case of African swine fever in its northwestern province. That, according to the Minister of Agriculture and Rural Affairs, the virus, fatal to pigs but not contagious to human beings, has significantly slashed pig output in the world's largest pig herd since the deadly disease was discovered in August of last year. China has reported outbreaks in all of its provinces on the mainland, as well as in Hong Kong and Hainan Island in the south. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for today, Monday, October 15th, we are looking, no major economic reports out today, but tomorrow we'll look for the Empire State Manufacturing Index. Wednesday, we're expecting data on monthly retail sales, along with notes from the Federal Reserve Beige Book, and we'll see earnings from Ferelgis Partners, PacWest Bank Corporation, and Tootsie Roll Industries Incorporated by the end of the day today. Just some of the things that could be moving the markets today on Monday, October 14th.